Of course, if you go forward in history, the left loses its connection to the working class and its role in pursuit of socialism and revolution. You end up with a left which is a very big myth maker. They're very big and mythed. I'm sounding like Trump here. But they excel perhaps in myth in the way that even the right doesn't. And I thought we might ask ourselves, what are the predominant left-wing myths today?
I do think left versus right is a good example of a myth in the sense that it is an attempt to slightly naturalize or definitely dehistoricize class struggle. So it's like left versus right, but it's not capitalist versus proletarian. It's not in class terms. It's precisely an attempt to try and put all these other things which are not to do with class in the place of class struggles. Anyway, I just wanted to make that meta point.
But it's a very important point. Like left and right is myth in a certain sense today, especially in the age of culture war.
I've noticed this thing where certain young people who are nominally on the left are using like class identity as identity, and it's a kind of new class identitarianism. And the whole myth of viewpoint politics is so deeply ingrained that they realize like the identitarianism of the past 40 years is not working. And they kind of get that we should talk about economics and class differences. So they're like, well, as a working class person, and oh my God, you're like so bourgeois. They use it in these moral terms. The morality of identitarianism is this deeply ingrained, ideologically like inculcated myth that the liberal left cannot escape from.
Can we become post-myth? Do we even want to? That's some of the words with which a recent documentary on Roland Barthes' mythologies ends. We'll come on to that documentary maybe in just a bit, but we are here to discuss that work, and we're very happy to be joined by Catherine New. It's been a very long time since she's last been on. Hello.
Hey.
And hello to George.
Hey, it hasn't been quite such a long time since I've been on, but thanks for not forgetting that I'm here as well. I appreciate it.
And hello to me, Alex. I guess you know who I am if you're listening as well, given this is the Reading Club. But maybe you're a new joiner, in which case, welcome. Welcome to the BungaCast Reading Club, where we take old works and new and investigate them, try to critically examine them. And this year in particular, we are choosing works that go along with one of our five thematic priorities this year, which, because I don't have them written down right in front of me, I'm going to try to remember them off the top of my head. I should have them, it should be at the tip of my fingers, but it might not be. We have the pre-political, we have militarism and war, we have state capitalism, we have political recombinations, and we have illiberalism irrationalism and something. I had some other word there.
I mean, irrationalism is an interesting one, because I'm sure we'll talk about myth and reason and all these sorts of things.
I was going to ask you all about the myth of the post in BungaCast, but there wasn't a post. There was only a pre. But I was going to actually razz on try to demystify your love of the prefix.
Us as a podcast or Alex?
Alex.
Alex does like a prefix. Yeah, this is
well.
True.
I actually remember
a prefix.
Speaking of post, I remember posting once that the fact that everything is post something nowadays speaks to our inability to actually be able to name where we are and what is going on. It speaks to the kind of diffuseness of the era.
Speak for yourself. I don't use post.
You don't use post. Okay, that's good. That's good. I'm going to go post.
Post,
to make a very George-like joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get started just to briefly introduce. You are probably familiar, have heard of this work at least. It came out in 1957. It's a collection of 53 short essays, which were written in the years preceding its publication, and not post, because that would be kind of complicated. And most of which were first published in the French literary review, Les Lettres Nouvelles. It draws on linguistics, especially socio-structuralism, some psychoanalysis, especially Freud, and plays with this idea of latent and manifest meanings, for example, of dreams. There's some Sartre and there's some Marx in it, and it's rather complicated. I think it's a rather challenging read, even if the content that occupies most of the book, the first, I don't know, three quarters of the book, in which Barthes examines specific myths, is actually quite intelligible. The theoretical scaffolding, which he introduces and works through towards the end, is a little bit more difficult, particularly its relationship to linguistic structuralism. And maybe Catherine can help us kind of rebuild that scaffolding so we know what it looks like as a whole and in its process of development, which indeed is I guess, a lot of what Barthes' concern is, to historicize and not make things appear natural and flattened. It's this work of demystification to show how the natural, or rather how the historical becomes naturalized, as he puts it.
By the bourgeoisie.
Well, I'm getting on to them. myth transforms history into nature. I mean, that's the most resumed summation of the book, and it's an almost direct quote from the book. To quote directly, myth has the task of giving an historical intention a natural justification and making contingency appear eternal, end quote. His concern in the book remains Marxist and revolutionary. It's bourgeois society that produces myths. And old dead myths are not of his concern here. Bourgeois society produces myths, and he polemicizes against the bourgeoisie for this reason. In fact, he argues that the only non-mythological is direct productive activity, where you speak directly to what you're doing. The woodsman, the woodcutter cuts tree. He speaks tree. He doesn't speak of or on or about tree. and the other non-mythological activity would be revolution. So we're going to come to those points as we work through this, because we want to inquire as to whether we think that's right. Just to cite some examples of myths that he works through, critiques in the first part of the book. The example that he most returns to is, to use the antiquated language, Negro soldier on the cover of Paris Match magazine, where this signifier stands for French imperiality, and French imperiality as inclusive and benevolent. Other famous ones include wrestling, how the staging of a morally clear and legible contest where suffering and punishment are immediately meaningful is brought out. Catherine wants to talk a little bit about wrestling, so we're going to come to her on that in just a second. There's steakfrit, a symbol of strength and vitality, timeless, essential French gastronomy. the notion of margarine is shown in an ad as to be disgusting, but then it turns out to be tasty and useful and cheaper than butter. So this is the technique of inoculation, to introduce critique of an institution as a way to inoculate the public from, a more thoroughgoing critique of said institution or the form of society in which we live. Another point which we will return to. Just two more quotes to kind of set up what this book is about before we actually work through it. Myth hides nothing. Its function is to distort, not to make disappear. I think that's important. And secondly, that myth is speech stolen and restored. Only speech which is restored is no longer quite like that which is stolen. So when something becomes mythified, it comes back different and altered. It's distorted, but it's not really making reality disappear. Anyway, some of these myths, do you guys have any favorites of yours that you would like to speak to?
Yeah, I think Catherine, do you want to go first with wrestling, and then I'll talk about wine, because I really like that one.
Wine, oh, okay. Now, I want to set the stage a little bit more, if you don't mind.
Go for it, please.
Barthes wrote this book during the explosion of consumer society in France. It was the beginning of what they call the 30 glorious years of growth, and much of it was facilitated by the Marshall Plan. And you have a society that was rigidly class-based, almost, you know, still really entrenched in the agricultural mode of production, the Catholic Church being a powerful institution, sort of rocked to its core by the introduction of just advertising and commodity goods. And when I teach the French New Wave, you know, the first film of which is shown